Mrs. Eddy by Hugh Studdard Kennedy. Chapter 4. The Last Year at Bow. In the autumn of 1832, when Mary was in her 12th year, her eldest brother, Samuel, married Eliza Glover, daughter of John and Nancy Glover of Concord. It was the first wedding in the Baker family of that generation, and a great occasion. Friends came to it from far and near. For several years previously, Samuel had been living in Boston, where he was doing well as a builder and contractor. And the fact that he came back to Concord to claim a bride from among his own people made the match a popular one. Among those present at the wedding was the bride's young brother, George, just past his majority. And in the merrymaking which followed the ceremony, he and Mary seemed to have been thrown very joyfully together. George Washington Glover was a happy, eager boy who loved to talk and be talked to. He was full of fun, and just the type and just the age to appeal to a little girl, who, in spite of all the deeps of a strangely questioning mind, had an almost exuberant capacity for enjoyment. Mary Baker, too, loved to talk. Her mother, in a letter written several years later, indicates rather pathetically how much she misses her chatter. And in the way of such gatherings, the little girl and the big boy became the best of friends. George was going back with his sister and his brother-in-law to Boston to learn the building business. So the wedding feast at Concord was, for him and Mary, a veritable hail and farewell. However, they made such good use of their time that when the party finally broke up, George hoisted the laughing, curly-headed Mary on his knee and swore that he would be back in 5 years' time to marry her. The incident was recalled afterwards when the two actually were married, but for the time being, George Glover went away to Boston and to new adventure, and Mary went back to the farm at Bow to wrestle with herself and her father over the question of unconditional election, to study Lindley Murray's grammar and the English reader, and to acquire through her brother Albert and through her own untrammeled studies a kaleidoscopic mass of general knowledge, to which only the years could give coherence. The next clear glimpse we get of Mary, and thereafter all is more clear, she is a few months over 14. It is a Monday afternoon in September 1835, September 7th to be exact, and she is writing to her brother Sullivan, who a few months previously had gone to Wethersfield, Connecticut. For some time, his health had not been good, and it was evidently thought that a change from the rigors of Bow to the comparatively mild climate of Wethersfield might be helpful. And Mary is writing to him. It is the letter already referred to. As the letter shows, she is alone in the house. Her father and mother and her sister Martha have gone to attend a funeral, but since it is the first letter preserved out of the many thousands destined to be written by the same hand in the future, perhaps it should be quoted with all its mistakes upon it. Writing from Bow, Mary begins. As I have an opportunity of sending you a letter by Mr. Cutchins without putting you to that expense, which any intelligence that I could communicate would ill repay, I improve it with pleasure. Then there is the passage already quoted, wherein she thanks Sullivan for his friendly advice and counsel, tells him how much she misses him, and reports her own improvement in health and the hope that she would, with care, sometime regain it. After rambling through various commonplaces, she quaintly concludes, "Although I did not receive the toothpick, I shall take the will for the deed and think much of them for coming from you. Write every opportunity. Excuse all mistakes, as this is the second letter I ever wrote, and accept the well wishes of your affectionate sister, Mary Baker." The picture that such a letter conjures up and the story that goes with it are both distinct. Years afterward, from her wide balcony window at Pleasant View, Mrs. Eddy could look down the valley of the Merrimack towards the high lands of her childhood's home at Bow. And in her book, Retrospection and Introspection, she wrote of the changes 50 years or more had made, how where once were broad fields of bending grain, waving gracefully in the sunlight, and orchards of apples, peaches, pears, and cherries shone richly in the mellow hues of autumn, now the lone nightbird cries, the crow caws cautiously, and wandering winds sigh low requiems through dark pine groves. And then, filling in the details of the picture, she recalls green pastures bright with berries, singing brooklets, beautiful wild flowers, and large flocks spreading themselves over rich acres. So it would have been on this Monday afternoon in September when Mary wrote to Sullivan. Perhaps the most important part of the letter, from the point of view of subsequent events, is the reference to the journey of her father and mother to Sandbunton to look at a farm. For within the next 6 months, the family were to move there. And the little town on the Winnipesaukee River was to see some of the most important events in Mary's early life. But for the moment, the chief value of the letter is the picture it affords of Mary herself. A queerly bookish, rather wistful little girl, already all too familiar with the handicaps against which she was to struggle through so many years. That the letter is decidedly solemn and sententious in parts reveals nothing of importance, save that Mary followed the fashion of the day, which demanded pathos in some form at some point in a letter, as almost a first requisite. No well-brought-up girl of 100 years ago could have written to an absent brother at any length without a reference of some kind to the uncertainties of life and the wanness of the outlook generally. There is reason, moreover, to suppose that the letter does not fairly represent Mary as she generally was. Something not accustomed was influencing her. She had remained at home alone when the rest of the family had gone off for the day. True, one purpose of the excursion was not very cheerful, to attend a funeral. But after the funeral, there was the new farm to be inspected, and the new farm represented to the family at Bow the possible culmination of a change which had evidently been under discussion for some time. The three sons had left home. Mark had prospered, and his three daughters, all distinguished for their beauty, were growing up. Beau was small, so small as to be hardly a village. Concord was only 4 miles away, but 4 miles was a long way, especially in winter, and it would be easier for everyone to be in a larger community where neighbors were separated by only a few yards instead of a few miles, and a handed tea or a reception did not involve a long cross-country journey. Sandbutton had just the facilities necessary. In ordinary circumstances, the prospect, one might suppose, would have been especially exciting to a young girl of Mary's age and temperament. But for some reason, she was not specially interested. Indeed, she evidently regarded the proposed move with such scant favor as to prefer remaining at home to taking any active part in its consummation. There was a reason, of course, for this apathy, and that reason was one Andrew Galt. Very little is known of Andrew Galt, save that he was the son, or as some authorities maintain, the nephew, of that same Sarah Galt, who was Abigail Baker's friend and confidant in the weeks and months before Mary was born. He was 6 years Mary's senior, and as may be gathered from a letter of Martha Baker's to Mary several years later, he had known Mary all her life. And so, if he was in love with her, as Mary was or thought she was with him, it must have been just about this time that the young man of 20 was beginning to realize that the little girl of short skirts and waving hair was growing up. As to Mary's feelings, the only testimony, indeed the only record of the incident at all, is to be found in two short poems, but they tell a great deal. The first she wrote and sent to Andrew, or perhaps, as was quite commended in those days, gave to him on parting just before the family left Beau. The second she sent to him from Sandbutton. Neither of them is great poetry. In fact, they are no better nor no worse than any girl of 14 or 15 in those days might have written in the circumstances. There are the same desperate dilemmas in the matter of rhyme, and the same fabulous solutions. In the first line of the opening verse, she finds it hard to take a final leave, and the nearest she can go to a rhyme in the third line is, "With unaccustomed grief my bosom heaves." The problem she had to solve was a difficult one, and the solution was not perfect. But one can think of many worse. And Andrew, it may be ventured, thought the whole thing just perfect. A vernal feeling thrills her very breast, and clasped hands linger fondly. But go, those finer feelings riven, which through my bosom shot, and with thee take this flower of heaven, the flower forget-me-not. And so Andrew got his forget-me-not and his goodbye, and one day, soon afterwards, he saw Mary drive down the hill from Beau and out of his life. For so it really was. No doubt his thoughts followed her with many vows as he watched the wagon disappear round the bend towards Concord. And equally, no doubt, Mary was firm in her constancy. in the poem she sent him soon after they had settled in their new home at Sandbutton. There is no doubt as to where her heart is, or as to where she thinks it is. It is in Bow, with its running brooks, so restful to the soul, wearied with studying worn-out books. There it was, she had lost her heart, and there, too, had she learned the sad truth. We live, we love, we part. Andrew, no doubt, received the poem with tears. It was the only way in those days he could have received it. And Mary, no doubt, meant every word of it. But although they may have seen each other occasionally in the years which followed, they drifted quietly and happily apart. He married, and Mary married, and the curtain never rose again on the old scenes.